Bhaktivedanta Swamini Dinamani Namaste Saraswati Devi Gaur Vani Pacharani Nirvishesha Shunyavari Puschachade Sitarani Omangyanam Timuranda Shaganjana Shalokaya Chaksurin Miritam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Maha. There's a small group, you can come in if you want. I don't have so much energy for speaking really loud. I'm kind of hoarse. Well, we've had full blowout days. Yesterday was Janmashtami. We celebrate the appearance of Krishna. And today, Vyasa Puja, we celebrate Srila Prabhupada's appearance. So it's like a party weekend in the middle of the week. And so we have people were up really late. We had a big program this morning at the temple. So I thought I'd just talk a little bit about Srila Prabhupada and some of the things I remember about him. Nothing especially fancy or anything. I guess you have to call my first realization about Srila Prabhupada happened before I was initiated, of course, before I moved in a temple. I encountered the devotees, I think, in the year of 1969. And in 69, there were not a whole lot of temples. But I had heard about Hare Krishna. And I even chanted one time the Hare Krishna mantra. But I didn't really know what it was about. But sometime in, I think, 67, there was a friend of mine who lived over in Powhatan Village, which at that time was the hippie section of town, just starting to be. And he was getting married, and they had a wedding that was typical. It was in the apartment. His bride was about ready to have a baby, so it was... and there were all different kinds of people. There was a priest there from the United Churches of Christ who was in the boilers for poor people or something. And so anyway, this wedding went by. People read from Tibetan Book of the Dead and various sorts of things like that. And then after the ceremony, we all went into the guy's bedroom. People sat around smoking marijuana. And my friend said, I have this far-out tape you got to hear of a guy I know sent it to me. So I put this tape in, which was Prabhupada chanting Hare Krishna. He had recorded this happening record. Prabhupada and a bunch of devotees had gone down to a studio with a bongo drum. Recorded the chanting of Hare Krishna mantra. And so we sat and chanted for a long time. And it struck me then that Prabhupada sounded to me like a voice that was calling from very, very far away. Maybe you hear a foghorn at sea or something like that. I had that sensation. So I, somehow or other, I knew of chanting, and I had actually chanted Hare Krishna with Prabhupada. Of course, I didn't know that was Prabhupada chanting at the time, I think. I didn't know what it was. So anyway, a few years later, I'm at, I see some devotees chanting down at the campus of Temple University. And I was kind of interested. And there had just been a temple started in Philadelphia. A couple of devotees had come down from New York because Prabhupada had been to Philadelphia the previous semester, and they'd gone to Temple University, actually. and Prabhupada had given a couple of lectures, and I think one person had joined the movement at that time. And so there was always talk going on about starting a temple in Philadelphia. So this one devotee came down, his name was Subaldas, and he stayed with various people and finally rented a little row house in, over near Baltimore Avenue behind the University of Pennsylvania in West Philadelphia. So there was maybe four or five devotees there. So I saw them chanting. And just about the same time, this friend of mine, the same one, the same guy who had that tape at his wedding years ago, comes to me and he's all excited about something called a love feast. It's far out. So I was persuaded to go to a love feast. In those days, the Sunday feast was at 10 o'clock in the morning or 11 o'clock in the morning or something like that, which was really early for me in those days. And so we all went out there, and I've described elsewhere that, you know, that it made quite an impression on me. The thing that really made the impression on me was the fact that the devotees were following four regular principles. And they understood that if you're serious about spiritual life, one has to become free from sense gratification. It was the first time I heard any religious group speak the truth. Everybody else would always try to tell you how you can have spiritual life and sense gratification at the same time. I knew it was wrong. I'd been studying religion for 3 years, and I looked at all the texts and all the traditions, and it was clear that this common thread was running through all of them. That if you really want transcendence, you want the real thing, you must become free from sense gratification. But we find out there's a whole lot of people who think they want transcendence but don't want to give up sense gratification. So therefore there are many religions. Unnecessarily many. Because little ways to compromise and to make arrangements and say yes but, okay but, or something like that. But the devotees were really staunch. And at that time I was a Mayavad. I was completely convinced about Mayavad philosophy. I'd speculated my way to the impersonal Brahman, although I had no realizations, I don't think. And I had been reading Shankaracharya and all these other things, and with some attention. And I just, and in fact, I thought the devotees were also impersonals in Mayavadis. Because I thought that was the only intelligent position there was. Well, I began to chant Hare Krishna because I wanted to bring my senses under control, and people said it would work. And the philosophy that if you give your senses a higher engagement, that'll keep them from doing lower things at least seemed reasonable. I didn't know whether it was true or not, but it seemed reasonable. So, and it was something you could do to see. Well, this was the age where people were taking these, you know, you were buying little pills from people you didn't know and ingesting large quantities of sometimes to find out the truth. So, a guy would say, oh, this is mescaline or this is psilocybin. You don't know what it was. The people were taking it. It was nuts. So just to sit with some japa bees and chant Hare Krishna was even relatively harmless, you know. I began chanting, and it had an amazing effect. Material desires began to abate just because of the chanting. And that was, to me, that was the proof that there was something there. And after a little bit of time of not chanting because I got scared of it, I felt worse not chanting, so I started chanting on a regular basis, and then I decided I wanted to figure out what is this Krishna? What am I involved in? Who are these people? I don't know anything about this, and here I am, I'm chanting. and it was almost a puzzle, because the devotees were, I don't know, they didn't communicate very well in those days. Maybe we still don't communicate very well, but it was weird. The things were weird in those days. People would tell you things that would be startling and incomprehensible, and expect you to already know them. And first of all, you go to the little temple, and there was all these rules and regulations you didn't know. And there was always somebody whose appointed job was this is my friend, later my friend Nayana Baram, we called him the enforcer. He always went around and said, don't step here, don't walk here, you know, do this, do that. Like when you first came to the temple in those days, you walked in and there was a bowl of rice, raw rice, I mean, raw rice at the entrance, right in the foyer. And you had to take it and put it on the mantelpiece. Nobody said, why is it? Said, take that rice and put it on the mantelpiece, you know. I put the rice on the mantelpiece. And nobody explained anything. And we only later found out that this temple room had no seat for Prabhupada, Vyasasana. So they had a picture of Prabhupada up on the mantelpiece. And it says in the Nectar of Devotion that it's an offense to enter a temple without bringing a present. So they thought that everybody that came there was an offender. So if we at least took a little rice in the foyer and deposited this little pinch of rice in the picture of Prabhupada, then we would be bringing a gift and we'd be free from offense. So things were... But I didn't find this out until years later, what was going on with the rice, you know. And so it took a while to try to figure out what was happening. And of course, the big thing, the first thing that happened, one of the things that happened is that I discovered that the devotees weren't Mayavadis. And I just never had this idea before. The idea that God should have transcendental name, transcendental form, transcendental activities, transcendental relationships, that Krishna was not a product of the illusory energy. They were not worshipping the impersonal absolute, and that Krishna was actually the source of the impersonal absolute. And it was almost as though I had no choice in the matter, because I was sitting one day, I don't know, one of my visits to the temple, and I was honoring prasad at the feast. And I had the whole kind of Mayavadi metaphysical structure, like a building or a pyramid or something, in my head, you know, a mental construct with the impersonal Brahman at the top. And I overheard somebody say to somebody else, one of the devotee ladies said to somebody else, she said to the other person, oh no, this is over my side, said, oh no, you don't understand, Krishna is beyond that light. That light comes from the transcendental body of Krishna. And it was just as though somebody had set a bomb underneath that Mayavadi structure, just went and just crashed. And I thought, what is this? What's going on? And the idea was like the most revolutionary idea I'd ever heard. You have to understand how deep I was into Mayavad philosophy. And then I spent a long time thinking about this, and I began to, you know, rearrange everything and look at it again and think it through. And it was my realization from studying Shankaracharya, after I'd heard this from the devotees, that actually Shankaracharya wasn't a Mayavadi. Shankaracharya is the big theologian that all the Mayavadis, who is the definitive producer of impersonal philosophy in India, goes back 1,000 years or more. And so I'd been studying Shankaracharya, But once I understood what the devotees were saying and I looked back at Shankaracharya, I could see that actually Shankaracharya was being very subtle and he wasn't really teaching Mayavad philosophy. And so one day I finally wanted, one devotee was giving a lecture, you know, about Mayavadis and Shankaracharya. So I did something I thought was going to be foolish as I argued with him, you know. I raised my hand and said, you know, I don't think that Shankaracharya is really a Mayavadi. And I was astonished when the devotee said, oh, you're right. He's Lord Shiva, actually. So the devotees, I was a university graduate student in religion, and here I had thought I was, you know, developing so far out there. And here these kids standing on a street corner chanting Hare Krishna knew more than I did. Much more than I did. Knew more than anybody I knew. So I began to think, what is this? This is amazing. No, this can't be right. And then I began to collect literature, and again, there wasn't so much of literature that was available in those days. I get what I could on my hands and read it over and over again. And then I had the other thing is that it looked like in Krishna consciousness, it looked to me at that time that Krishna consciousness was the original religion. And that all other religions had taken some part of it and run with it. And then for the first time I was seeing it all together. And I couldn't believe it. Here was this little rundown row house in West Philadelphia with these people. But there it was. You know, maybe I'm wrong. I looked at it again. Nope. Every time I thought through the whole thing, there it was. Krishna consciousness was the absolute truth. I said, how is it possible? People all over the world for looking for the absolute truth. Everyone says, I've got it. And now I believe I've got it. How could that be true? But then, you know, I think it through, and there it is. So I said, well, this is really it. This is what everybody's looking for. So then I went to the religion department where I was a graduate student and tried to tell people, hey, here it is, you know. And I was amazed that nobody could see it. I just couldn't handle it. Anyway, though, the point I want to get to, when I looked at all this and at the state of Krishna consciousness, and I saw it was sitting here. The other thing was I had been planning in my mind, after studying philosophy of religion for 3 years, I always been thinking, because I was studying in the university, not because I wanted to be a university teacher. That was almost, to me, a fate worse than death. What I wanted to do was find out the truth. And I just knew I wasn't going to find it out sitting around with people with long hairs and, you know, dilated pupils. That wasn't going to work. So, but I also realized I wasn't going to find it out among the logicians and things like that, who are also beginning to have dilated pupils. Then I thought, well, you know, I'm going to have to go to India, right? I'm going to have to go to India and actually find a spiritual master. That's what I thought. And then all of a sudden, you know, here's this thing that shows up in West Philadelphia, this little rundown storefront, sort of almost in my, you know, not too far from my old neighborhood. You know, I went to school there and everything. So I'm trying to figure out how did this get here? What's it doing? So one day, there was a piano in the rear of the temple room. The temple room was the living room. See, the row house was a furnished row house. So it had a baby grand piano. And when they would get crowded at the Sunday feast, some of us had to listen to the lecture crouched under the piano. The devotees never played it, but it was there. Now, and one day I was there, I guess it was at the Sunday feast, and I saw these, it was a mimeograph sheet, actually. This was before photocopying. It was a You know, somebody cut a stencil. It was a mimeographed sheet of paper, and I saw it was some Sanskrit and some English, the Sanskrit I think was all in capital letters, Samsara Dava Nalalita Loka. So I just picked it up and took it home with me to read it later, because I was trying to try to get my hands on anything I could figure out what's going on. And when I got home, I sat down and I read this, and these are the prayers to the spiritual master by Vishwanath Chakravarti Goswami, which now we sing every morning at Mangal Arati. Prabhupada didn't actually start that until later. I mean, it's maybe 70, sometime in 71. Prabhupada said that Mangal Arati is for the worship of the spiritual master, and this is the song you sing. That was not a very familiar, nothing I'd ever heard before, but I sat down and I read these prayers. The spiritual master is receiving benediction from the ocean of mercy, just as the rain cloud pours water on the forest fire to extinguish it, so the spiritual master extinguishes the blazing fire of material existence. I offer my obeisances and the lotus feet of such a spiritual master, and so on. It goes through 8 verses describing just as the attributes of the spiritual master. The last one, Yasya Prasada Bhagava Prasado Yasya Prasada Nagati Utopi, by the mercy of the Guru, one receives the mercy of Krishna. Yasya Prasada Bhagavat, by his mercy, Bhagavat Prasado, there's the mercy of the Lord. Yasya Prasada, when without his, the spiritual master's mercy, Nagati Gutopi, nobody gets anywhere. Literally, nobody gets anywhere. Therefore, Dayam Stuvam Yasya Trisanjam, 3 times a day. Means at dawn, at noon, and at dusk, I should offer my prayers to my spiritual master, which is what people who chant Gayatri 3 times a day of brahminical initiation, there's mantras to the guru at that time, that's when it's chanted. So I read this, and I said, well, there it is. That's the key. You know, how this got, because I'd heard people talk about Srila Prabhupada and tell Prabhupada stories and things like that, but it just wasn't exactly, there was, as I said, there was no Vyasasana. He was not, in fact, Prabhupada was not famous. It was much later on, maybe 73, 74, that I remember a group of us sitting around, and we suddenly realized there were these big gurus coming through at that time. The first one was Maharshi Mahesh Yogi. They called him Maharishi in those days, but they've corrected their Sanskrit now. And then there was this Guru Maharaji, was big, very, very big. He was the one that had this big satsang in Houston, Texas, where he sat on a plexiglass Vyasasana and was supposed to announce the coming golden age or something. He was a boy, he was a 13-year-old boy, and his followers used to, you'd meet his followers and they would tell you, how much they love Krishna, and then you'd find out that by Krishna they meant this boy, who used to dress up and put on a flute and have girls dance around him and stuff like that. Anyway, he was quite big at one time, and we would be preaching Krishna consciousness and one Sunday feast is, half the people are there. They're always talking about the latest fad to come through, whether Guru Maharaji or Guru this or Guru that. So it was like a time of these like big gurus who were showing up. And we realized at that time, I guess about 70, 72 or 73, that all these gurus are famous. But actually, Prabhupada wasn't famous. At that time, nobody knew his name. Practically speaking, he wasn't famous. And we realized that Prabhupada's work had such that that the Hare Krishna mantra and the name of Krishna was famous all over the world, but nobody knew who Prabhupada was. Whereas these other people, these other gurus, they had made themselves famous. These so-called gurus, we have to say so-called gurus, they made themselves famous, and that's all. But it was Prabhupada who just made Krishna famous. And we had this as a realization that actually it was our duty as Prabhupada disciples to make him famous, to glorify Srila Prabhupada. And actually, we had some discussions throughout ISKCON about it, and it was kind of a conscious decision that this was something we ought to do. So, in those days, Prabhupada, it was not clear just who Prabhupada was, because ISKCON was at that time just entering into another level of expansion, I think. When I came to the temple, Prabhupada had just I moved into the temple in January of 71, and they had just started having Mangal Arati at 3:30, 4 o'clock, something like that, and just started to having a regular morning program. I was actually in 71 when a Bhagavatam class. Somebody was sitting down with the Bhagavatam and just start reading the book, and then every so often read a verse, the purport, say any questions, read the next verse, the purport, say any questions. We wouldn't chant the Sanskrit slokas. You know, all this stuff was in the future that Prabhupada would organize. And it was just going through a change from a very kind of small, very intimate group of people around Prabhupada to something that was getting bigger, where there was a whole lot of people that didn't have a lot of personal association with Srila Prabhupada like me. But anyway, I had realized then, before I moved in the temple, from reading these prayers, who Srila Prabhupada was and that everything depended upon him. And I read this, Yasya Prasadad Bhagava Prasado, Yasya Prasada Nagati. Without his mercy, nobody gets anywhere. So I realized that I needed Srila Prabhupada's mercy. And the real reason I needed Srila Prabhupada's mercy is I couldn't figure out how to get myself into the temple. I wanted to move into the temple. Now, I read that you don't have to move into a temple to be Krishna conscious, but I did. that was my conclusion. I couldn't do it otherwise, but I couldn't figure it out. I was married, had one child, another child on the way, had just purchased a house, entangled in graduate school, graduate student, and I had so many, I taught religion that, they take graduate students and turn them in, they stick them in front of classes and call them teachers. And so I was teaching religion 101 and stuff like that at the university, and teaching freshman English and all that kinds of stuff. And had all these obligations to me. For the life of me, I couldn't figure out how I was going to get from where I was now into the temple. At that time, my wife, who was going to have a baby, was not really interested in looking at Krishna consciousness until after she had the baby. Basically, feel like going through metaphysical changes, at least at the pace I was going through them. So I didn't know what to do. And so that's when one day I surrendered to Srila Prabhupada. I just prayed. I want to be your devotee, but I don't know how to go about it. I just can't get from where I am now to what I know I have to do to get there. Just please help me. And after that, one by one, all these insurmountable obstacles went bloom, 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 bloom. I mean, I didn't move into a temple in any very graceful, neat manner, tying up all the loose ends nicely. It was in the end a little messy, but anyway, got there. So I knew that was by the grace of Srila Prabhupada. So I did not see Srila Prabhupada physically until I got initiated. We didn't get a chance to hear too many of his tapes either, because this was also before cassette tape recorders were available. And the temple had this big old reel-to-reel Grundig, in which kirtans were played, and you had to haul the thing in and set it down. But we used to listen during prasadam to the Prabhupada lecture. And of course, the first time I heard Prabhupada, I couldn't understand a word he was saying. And it took a while of listening before I began to understand his accent and understand his English. So by the time I saw Srila Prabhupada, I didn't have any trouble that way. But I actually saw him. He was gone when I joined the temple, which was in January, and then in July, Sodamini and I got initiated. All during that time, when I moved to the temple, and even before then, Prabhupada had been in India and other places. He was out of the country. So he was coming back to America after a long absence. And fortunately for us, he would come to New York. That was like the big headquarters, really. He would always go to New York and Los Angeles. So there was a series of initiations. It was just getting to the point where Prabhupada was initiating people by mail, but that was a new thing. It was very awkward because you had to get your beads through the mail back and forth to him and so on. But they had just, because he was coming, a lot of people had just waited until he would show up. So there was, I don't know how many days of initiations, or like every morning a fire sacrifice with initiations. And so he went up to the New York Temple, which at that time was in Henry Street in Brooklyn. And that's from where it was moved since then. But that was an old Catholic nursing home at one time. And there was a brand new temple room that was just fixed up. I think when Prabhupada left New York, they were on 2nd Avenue, not 26th Second Avenue, but there was a second place further up the avenue that was their place. And that's when Prabhupada left, and they had since moved to Henry Street. And when I first went to New York Temple, that temple room was a temporary one on the second floor while they were renovating the first floor. So it was all ready when Prabhupada came back. And because Sadamini and I were out of town and they wanted to take the out-of-town devotees and process them through fast, we got initiated in the first day. And I think I saw Prabhupada for the first time when he came into the temple room for giving Srimad Bhagavatam class in the morning. And I was just amazed to see the visual presence. In other words, I'd had the audio portion of the show for some time, and suddenly there's a visual, you know. And the first thing, of course, I mean, there was all these devotees offering obeisances and having a kirtan and everything. Is that Prabhupada was just so perfect. He wasn't putting on airs or just walking into the temple room. That's all. It wasn't like people were glorifying that he thought it was for him or anything like that. He was just very simply ordinary way, just walking in. And so he gave Bhagavatam class. And I was watching him very carefully. The first thing he did was something I'd never seen before. You know, he picked up a glass of water, tilted his head back, and poured the water down his throat without the water touching, the glass touching his lips, which is the clean way to do it. I'd never seen anyone do that before. But I'd also seen him fill the glass, and I thought that his glass had a lot of ice in it. And I couldn't figure out. I kept the ice cubes from pointing. But it was his gesture was so precise, and I thought that was an amazing thing. Actually, what I saw that Prabhupada never did anything carelessly, even if it was a very small little thing. He didn't do it carelessly. It was like drinking the water. It was not done carelessly. So then I noticed that Srila Prabhupada was effulgent, just watching him. And I looked at it because it was interesting, because I noticed that it wasn't like there was a light that emanated from Srila Prabhupada. Sometimes you see in medieval paintings, you know, it's just you see a light coming out, as though it was a kind of light that would cast a shadow, like a light source, a light bulb behind the person or something. It wasn't like that, but it was that on the person of Srila Prabhupada, and maybe immediately around him, it was as though he was under a more intense light. And the effect of more intense light is colors are more saturated, and boundaries are more well defined. So it just looked like he was better drawn. You know, it was that effect of very bright light on him, without any shadows or like that. I sat there watching, you know, trying to figure that one out for a while. But that was the first time I saw Prabhupada. So just then, later that day, there was initiation ceremony, which was a very long ceremony. Prabhupada came in, and there must have been, I don't know, 15 or 20 people at that fire sacrifice. I mean, it was big, all the way around the room, it seemed, all these people. And Prabhupada sat down on the Vyasasana, and there was a whole bundle of japa beads for him to chant on. And he chanted personally on all the beads right there in front of us. So we sat there for a long time while Prabhupada chanted the Hare Krishna mantra on every single set of beads. Later on, Prabhupada assigned the job of chanting on the beads to some other people. But this time he was still doing it personally. But there were just so many people getting initiated, so he empowered either his own, you know, whoever was his GVC secretary would chant on the beads, or then later on, different parts of the country had different sannyasis who would chant on beads. And also at that time, Prabhupada was still personally picking people's names. Later on, his Sanskrit editor would pick the names. When he came to Philadelphia in 75, there was a bunch of people to get initiated, and Prabhupada would lean over and said, "What's his name?" And somebody would say, Prabhupada would say, "Where'd you get that from?" And then he would change it sometime. You know, when he Vishnu Sahasranama, Prabhupada. So that time he picked the names of stuff. But it was amazing. We sat there while Prabhupada chanted on every single strand of japa beads with great paying attention, looking at the beads and everything. And then of course he came up one by one and told them what the regular principles were, took our vows, and he handed the beads to us. I couldn't understand what my name was. What is his name? Govinda Swarup, what is it? And I asked other people, what's my name? And I don't know, I have Govinda Swarup. Everybody thought it was. So then afterwards I went to, had to go to somebody who had the list. They says, "No, Ravindra Swarup." I said, "Oh." And Prabhupada said to me, when he said my name, he said, "Your name means like sunshine." And that also, at that time I was, before I became a devotee, I was really into astrology, and that being like sunshine had some affinities to what I thought was my, you know, astrological nature and stuff like that. I thought, how did Prabhupada know about that? Never saw.